Hello, and welcome again to Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshinworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. I'm Diane Fink, CEO of Shoshinworks, and your host for the day. And today we're diving into the complex world of open innovation, community building, and the structures that enable breakthrough connections in our rapidly changing environment. I'm delighted to be joined today by my brilliant co-host, Marco Annunziata. Marco brings exceptional insight to our conversations about ecosystemic transformation through his extensive background in global economics and technological innovation. Marco, thanks for being here with us today. Why don't you share a little bit about your background for our listeners, and then we'll introduce our guest.
Now, your introduction of me was so flattering that I'm tempted to say nothing more and leave it at that. I am a PhD economist. I started my career in policy in the International Monetary Fund, and then I spent about 10 years in finance, and then I moved to industry. So I was with GE as the chief economist and working on innovation with you, Diane. And that's where I carved out this niche of expertise at the intersection of global economics, geopolitics, and technology and innovation. And that really sums it up.
Amazing. We're so lucky to have you on board here, Marco. Thank you. And now we are absolutely thrilled to welcome our distinguished guest, Terry Schindler, co-founder of and CEO of Herzog & Schindler and owner of Polyplexus.com. Terry brings decades of experience in building innovation platforms that facilitate dynamic ecosystems for collaboration and discovery. As a DARPA performer, she contributed to groundbreaking projects focused on information hierarchy with a team from MIT Media Lab and was part of the consortium that developed Polyplexus, a platform basically designed to increase the efficiency in what she calls the first mile of innovation. We're going to dive into that a little bit more today. She's collaborated with multiple government agencies, including ARPA-H, on horizon scanning and idea generation. What makes Terry's perspective particularly fascinating is her diverse background. Before focusing on innovation platforms, she was a multi-Emmy award-winning winner in media, producing content for NBC, CBS, and HBO. At the MBA, she distributed broadcast content to over 400 countries and was a founding member of the WNBA team. She later became president of Davis Brand Capital, working with Fortune 100 clients and on brand and digital strategies. Terry attended the University of Notre Dame, go Irish, graduating Phi Beta Kappa, and as an all-American swimmer, her career journey represents a powerful convergence of brand, content, community, and distribution, precisely the elements that make ecosystemic approaches so effective today. Terry, welcome to Ecosystemic Futures. We're thrilled to have you.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And so amazed with your journey and what lies ahead for you. I'm sure we probably oversimplified that introduction. Anything else about your journey or your areas of focus that you might share with our listeners before we dive in?
No, just an abiding and constant fascination with community and how community changes as structures and culture change and what we can do to facilitate some of those connections. We've been thinking a lot about transactional and relational competencies and how they weave together. And so I think all those things come into how you build community today.
Right. And community is increasingly important in this hyper-connected world. And I'm really excited to really dig into your work and how you view community underpinning economy, society, and policy. So with that, why don't we dive in? And really, as we're talking about the world today, it is quite complex. It is increasingly interconnected and interdependent, which adds a new layer of dynamism in society, industry, and policy. So sense-making within complexity is super important, right? And not necessarily a capability that we have all kind of overdeveloped over the past several decades, right? We have been very focused on models that are configured for productivity, efficiency, right? and today's economy really functions in interconnectivity and community. So let's maybe start with that first mile of innovation that we mentioned earlier. You've described the first mile of innovation as inherently chaotic, which I love, and often dependent on serendipity. We like to think of that as structured serendipity. Could you maybe walk us through what makes this phase so challenging and what principles you find are most useful in that phase?
Yeah, I think it's helpful also to describe some of the challenges that organizations were having, like DARPA. So at the end of the day, we don't know what we don't know. So you cannot see what you don't know that you're not seeing. And we live in a society, in a culture that's ruthlessly efficient in the last mile. But there's a lot of wandering around in the desert for the first mile. It takes a lot of time. It relies on serendipity, even if it's structured serendipity. And there's a lot of time spent sort of identifying what is the question. And I think one of the things that led me to Polyplexus is it was a DARPA program. It began as a DARPA program. And one of their issues at the time that they had identified was that they were seeing a lot of the usual suspects. I use that sort of short-term movie analogy. There were people, there were structures that are just primed to go through their BAAs, their broad agency announcements, and try to figure out what they're looking for and try to answer their calls. And then when proposals don't get accepted, they get reformatted for the next set of questions that come out, next set of proposals that come out. And so they realized they weren't reaching who they weren't reaching, and they didn't know how to expand that. And one of the reasons I understood that a little bit is when I was a performer at DARPA, we were considered non-traditional performers. And those are like not your typical people that would do this. So our company was too small. We didn't have anybody dedicated to looking at BAAs or understanding what questions they were asking. And so it was extremely serendipitous. I happened to know a program manager. He happened to know the work I was doing. And so we were able to connect, but that was an accident, right? And so what DARPA was looking to say, hey, can we systematically try to spread the net a little wider? There's a value in broadening the field. So that's sort of the genesis of how this all happened is could we get a broader set of ideas? And then once we get those broader set of ideas in the door, can we use social networking principles? Can we use evidence and community principles to increase the, it's not even the validity, but the matching of our abstracts, right? If I'm going to send you something, can we winnow it down a little bit before you actually set it in? So there's a better chance of a match. There's a better chance of us actually finding the question. So it was really about how, what kind of a system can we construct that help us meet who we don't know already and then structure a system so that we can winnow some of the ideas down in ways that are very useful and very helpful, help accelerate that first mile.
So, and that's fascinating. And that first mile is such a challenge for so many innovators and product managers, right, around the world. That's been really a persistent and acute challenge for a lot of innovation professionals.
Yeah, I've had researchers come and say to me, look, a lot of it is I run into somebody in a hallway at a conference. And I happen to say, hey, what are you working on? And then you tell me, I'm like, wait, that has an application to what I'm trying to figure out or where I'm trying to get to, or that helps crystallize the question in my mind. But obviously, we can't spend our time in those hallways, right? It would be great. So Polyplexus is an effort to try to create that hallway digitally that you can spin it up more quickly. You can put people into contact with one another quickly, and then you can structure an inquiry in a way that helps accelerate that pattern recognition.
And I think that it's probably worth emphasizing the features of structuring the interaction, the search, and making it efficient, right? Because when we think about serendipity, some of it brings to mind at an individual level the time you spend just gazing at the stars and the trees and listening to the birds, or cruising the internet and just casually waiting to hit on the right idea and letting really chance take its course. But in the world we live in, the problem is there is a flood of information. There is a scourge of people doing research. So if you're at a conference, similarly, you will run into tens and tens of people, many of whom will not be doing anything you're interested in. So the Polyplexus effort to bring some structure and some efficiencies to combine, just have the serendipity, but not in the wasteful way that casual conversations can sometimes bring, because in this world, we can't afford that anymore. Is that a fair characterization?
It's a totally fair characterization. I think structure is really important. At Herzog & Schindler, we talk a lot about structured strategy, really creating frames that facilitate certain outcomes. And in this particular case, friction has another meaning when you get into social networking, right? We didn't want a system where you could just say anything at any time. So it had to be evidence-based. And that little bit of friction, what's the DOI? What's the sourcing? Really helps increase the value of the information that is shared, right? And sort of the quality of the information that is shared. So if you can take some friction, and if you can use social networking mechanics, and maybe even some gamification mechanics, all of those things that we know how they work in those other areas, if we can combine those in a platform. So we used to say that the way it was structured was content creates community. So we had a Twitter-like feed or an X-like feed at the front end that was really about evidence. And it's based on that as a building block. So what have you seen? What is a piece of evidence from a paper that has been published? And then the ability to combine two pieces of evidence and create a conjecture, a hypothesis. I can take, Marco, your idea. Diane, I can take your idea. And I can suggest, hey, if these two things are both true, would it be possible to X, and just actually ask a question of the community? And that's really just the flypaper, right? That's the way it works. What we're trying to do behind that wall then is create custom communities of inquiry. So here's the subject. It works really well if it's multidisciplinary. Here's what we're trying to do. These are the questions we're trying to answer. Here's how we're looking at it. What should we know? And then it sort of operates much more like Reddit or LinkedIn, right? It's a grouping of information. And one of the things that we found is what really drives this is this desire for access. So Polyplexus is structured as a two-sided marketplace. On the one hand, it's people with ideas who say, how do I get access to the systems that can develop an idea? And I think the ARPA-H example, which I know we'll talk about, is a really good example of that. And then on the other side of the equation, for the people who are looking for the ideas, how do I get access to new ideas? How am I going to just, and then have a winnowing effect that I can sort of evaluate these ideas for the purposes of what we're trying to accomplish? So I think that that's the structure is absolutely critical. And then it's sort of the mechanics in between. So if we can use some social networking mechanics like more like this, I'm not really interested in this, unless you can make a persuasive argument as to why I should be interested in this. But by doing that in a really systematized way, that helps accelerate the whole process. And it drives other benefits like increases match rates on abstracts that are submitted, increases collaborative events that happen sort of in the course of that custom community, in the course of that knowledge search.
Amazing. So do you ever get to the point where IP becomes an issue or is something that you need to kind of create frameworks for or solve for within this community?
So we're fully pre-competitive knowledge. So we're really dealing in stuff that has been structured. And so if we create a custom community, we're very clear about if you have IP that you need to do this, you need to go through a different door. But if we're really just looking at horizon scanning ideas that are potentially possible, if you want to put forth some things, use this mechanism to do that. And I can explain a little bit further about this. But, you know, what we have found is, especially in the research areas, there are people who just generate ideas. They are just really, really good at identifying different ideas and different possibilities. I have a goddaughter who has an entrepreneurial effort that's based on science. And she was out talking to a potential investor. And he said, listen, I'm not interested in investing in your startup here, but I'm really curious about that notebook you've got in your hand. And she said, these are all my ideas. And he said, so I will give you the money you want for your startup for that notebook. And she said, I don't think so. But so this idea of trying to capture these ideas and get them in a place where they can be evaluated together with a community before they are competitive It's sort of looking at novel areas of inquiry is really where we're focused. I think there's definitely applications on the back end to look at using both AI and blockchain to try to, that's sort of our back end development to-do list so that we could get into some more competitive exchange.
I love that. I love the concept of getting kind of the creative process on the chain, because I think that will unlock a lot more disclosure of ideas and possibilities, because our IP system, right, and the commercialization system today, it favors folks with resources, right, and tenacity. And so the idea folks, right, don't necessarily always get to see their contributions travel into market.
Correct. Yeah, so, that's definitely. So right now, it's still a pre-competitive marketplace with the idea that we could create that and enhance the ecosystem even further.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, let's circle back to the ARPA-H example, if that's okay. If you could maybe walk us through what we need to know about that. I'm fascinated with kind of how that came together and where that ended up.
It was a really exciting, and I'm so appreciative of them for being willing to look at this way. It's not always typical of a government agency. So they were coming up on their first anniversary, and they did have a couple of things they had to do. One is they had to get feedback from all 50 states that they had to report to Congress, but they also really wanted to, as a brand question, differentiate themselves from NIH. They're under the NIH umbrella, but they were going to try to do a different approach to all of this. And then the third leg of that stool was they were really interested in what the field was. Where were the opportunities to transform U.S. health? Forget my BAA that I'm putting out or my RFP that I'm putting out, but what did the field think? What did experts in the field think were the low-hanging fruit or really intriguing opportunities to transform? So we talked to them and we set up a system where they said, what we really want to do is just ask the field, do you have a big idea to transform U.S. health? Period. That is the question. And by setting up a system, so we said, if you have an idea and it's further down the chain, go in through, we have a mechanism, we'll sign NDAs, we'll do all of that. But if you just work in the field and you see this every day, and this is not an idea you're necessarily going to follow up, or you might follow up on it, but what do you see as the pressing need or the pressing opportunity to change health? We have six questions, and they were based on the Hallmeyer Catechism that DARPA uses, which is sort of what's the current state? What is your proposed change? What is some evidence that suggests that this is possible? So it methodically goes through an idea. But that was it. So there were six questions that you could fill out, and it was just a form. So it was deceptively difficult. It seemed like, oh, six questions, no problem. Let me just dash this off. But it was difficult. You had to explain it in a short amount of words, and you had to make it no jargon, and you had to sort of describe the proposed transformation. But what it did was it opened the door to hearing from these people, but in a very structured way. So I suppose you could have set up stakeholder interviews and talked to 6,000 people, but this was a more efficient way to do it. And so what people did was they filled these out, and it was open for 10 days. We got more than 500 ideas, and then we put those ideas through. But the more important thing for us is that they came from a variety of sources. So this was one of their big goals, is the audience. They wanted community health advocates. They wanted institutions. They wanted foundations. They wanted experts. They wanted academics. So they wanted this larger field. So their custom community was very broad and then narrow in terms of the sense of health transformation. And so after we collected those ideas, we structured them in a March Madness bracket, which is, I guess, timely to talk about. And interestingly, despite my background in sports, I had absolutely nothing to do with this. This was suggested to us by another group of people that they said, hey, this would be really interesting to sort of have a community winnow ideas down to the most realizable, the most transformative. So you set the criteria. So we had the subject matter experts review the 500 plus ideas. And they narrowed it down to 64 that they thought were all worthy of consideration against different lenses that they had as ARPA-H, right? So they seeded the brackets, and then we opened it up to our community. And we have about 7,500 people in our community, but we also leave it open. So in this particular case, ARPA-H's dash was open to the U.S. only. We did geofence it for U.S., but the people were able to come in, and you were able to just vote. You were able to look at the ideas. So the ideas were all on a bracket. You could look at each one. They were all so important to your point about structure, Marco. They were all structured exactly the same way. Here's the title. Here's the proposed transformation. Here's how it's currently done. So that there's sort of a apples to apples looking at it. And then underneath each idea, you could add a comment. I think this has real merit. I've seen other evidence that supports this, or there's a lot of noise out there around this idea. I don't think it's completely achievable at this time. So people would leave chains of comments underneath each idea. And then every 3 days, we would close a round. So Diane, your idea went up against Marco's idea, and then one of them emerged. We did retain the right, and we were very clear about this, that we had the right to overrule the crowd and say, no, this one really has more. And we never did it throughout the whole thing. And that was really ARPA H's prerogative, but they never did overturn any of the decisions. And we worked our way down to a final four that we had to use different terminology to avoid being sued by the NCAA. But we were able to get that down to four really interesting ideas that all had broader applications. And then I think the most interesting thing to this, and I want to just make sure I'm citing this correctly, but one of the more interesting things about this was that was one drug for all cancers, a really interesting approach towards looking at cancer treatments. But Soleno is a small biotech firm in the Boston area, and they were the second semifinalist. They were talking about your cells, your cure. So it was personalized medicine. But a year later, after the competition was over, and ARPA-H was very clear, they said as a direct result of understanding what they were doing from their participation in the DASH, Soleno Biotech was awarded $25 million in research funding over 5 years for their next generation biomanufacturing ultra-scalable approach, which they call Nebula. And then subsequently, a few months later, they launched the US's first Nebula-powered iPSC foundry for scalable biomanufacturing. So this is the kind of thing that can happen where you discover something you didn't know, and it turns out that that's something that is worthy. So they did their due diligence on the back end of that. This first mile was really discovery. They wanted to see what was out there. They wanted to see. The other thing that was super interesting about this is, of all the ideas that were there, and there were really very many that were quite interesting, there were also a dearth of ideas on certain other things. So one of the things that they noted from their insights was no one had really submitted on women's health as a separate area of inquiry. And so they said, hey, we need to do something about women's health because we need to fill that gap. If the market that's out there is not really thinking about this as a transformative thing for US health, and we think it is, it looks to us like we have a role to play here to start to fund this, because that's not bubbling up.
That's actually a really important vantage point. So we have a lot of conversations with NASA, with our sponsors, about kind of the role, the really important role that these key government agencies have to play. They have that vantage point to look across the innovation landscape, the entrepreneurial landscape, and say, okay, what are the wicked problems, the more complex problems or challenges that society faces? And where are the challenges that basically transcend the reach or the interest of any one organization or even any one sector, right? So that ARPA-H example just reinforces that, right? The agencies just really are ambassadors of the interests, the ultimate interests of society and humanity. And it's an important role. And I love the fact that ARPA-H took a community-based approach to solving this discovery opportunity and beginning kind of the solution pathways, kind of beginning to really seed some investment in really critical areas. Brilliant. And so often the folks that aren't using these community-based models, Terry, will conflate, they aren't familiar with the models and the nuances, and they'll oftentimes conflate open innovation, community models, and open source. And it's easy to do, right? So I'm wondering if you maybe use your ARPA-H example, but if you can help us unpack those distinctions for our listeners, I think you'll be doing a great service to humanity for kind of organizing this for us.
Well, I think that when we talk about open innovation, a lot of times you say open innovation and someone hears open source. And I think the big differences for us are, we would say the key characteristics of open innovation really include collaboration, active seeking of external inputs and ideas, knowledge sharing across boundaries, iterative and agile processes that encourage adaptation and development of innovation ecosystems. where it differs from open source is open innovation often incorporates a business model, and open source often precludes one, right, initially. But it really comes around intellectual property. So open innovation still leaves aspects of intellectual property policy unanswered. Where I think they combine, where what we're trying to do with Polyplexus, and where I'm trying to say, hey, here's both sides of this equation, is open innovation, and Diane, I'd be really interested in your perspective on this because of your work at GE, but open innovation efforts usually are run by one company trying to innovate by reaching outside its walls, whereas open source focus on the problem or opportunity itself. What we are trying to do at Polyplexus is focus on the opportunity or problem, sometimes through the lens of an agency or a group of people, but it's not as closed. It's really open to the community to have a larger discussion around that. And that's kind of where those two meet on Polyplexus. But we are extremely clear about the intellectual property considerations, and we're not trying to post open source everything. And we're not trying to do that to people and their ideas. What we are trying to do is surface those ideas. And one of the reasons, so that access is so important. One of the things we found in the ARPA-H group of people, this was important for us, is that they ran the gamut, right? From a Stanford or an MGH, big institutions, and an IBM who wanted to enter that and sort of get their idea out in front of the ARPA-H people. But it also included smaller institutions not known for their research capacities necessarily. So smaller institutions, smaller universities, some foundations, and they can't get access to that network, right? Like a Duke and a Stanford and these tier one research institutions, they're getting that access. But there's a lot of people and a lot of researchers that are in other institutions that it's harder for them to get to that table. And so just the access itself helps to drive that open innovation and that sort of diversity of ideas.
I love that. And I think we're touching on a topic that Marco and I have discussed frequently and for quite some time now, right? We believe, or Marco, I'll speak for myself, and I'd love you to chime in here as our resident economist, but we believe these community-based models, ecosystemic models, are really beginning to reframe kind of the new economic engine for industry and society, right? Because of the interdependency that we're seeing, these generalized kind of technologies are beginning to form kind of a digital infrastructure underpinning flows of information, collaboration, connection, and transaction, right? You have this digital infrastructure and then systems of information, systems of incentive need to adjust in order to support this new economic engine, if you will. Listening to your example about the access, the need for access, we're seeing a similar phenomenon in the space economy, right? Where entrepreneurs and small businesses are really developing brilliant capabilities, very difficult to do. There are so many unknowns, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unplowed ground, if you will. And really, the space economy favors the big and the big budgets, right? So there are a lot of large organizations, very tenured, mature organizations that, and we're at risk of those large organizations kind of hoovering up those small businesses, locking up all those capabilities, which would be unfortunate. I'd love to see more of an ecosystemic approach to your point, Terry, maintain a healthy tension between kind of the scrappy and kind of sassy entrepreneurial landscape, developing, right, those really amazing capabilities, and the large mature organizations bringing that stability and kind of depth to the economy. But we need those community-based models, right? That
Polyplexus
and government's new role.
Yeah. Right? And I think they're different personality profiles too.
Yes. So
the risk profiles of someone who's in a large organization versus someone who's in a sort of scrappy startup. So that's all important also, because it frames the way the thinking is. That when you're talking about the first mile, it really frames the question differently in some cases. I couldn't agree more. I think that diversity of the community is really, really important.
Super important. Marco, I love your thoughts here. I know we've spent a lot of time kind of thinking through these issues.
Yeah, no, just a couple of comments. One is the emphasis, the importance of identifying the right questions, which I think is a huge value added of this approach that is laying out. It brings to mind, naturally, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where you realize that the key is really asking the right question. Otherwise, you're going to waste a lot of time, get to some answer, and then wonder, what do I do with this? I mean, the other comment I would make is we do live in a world which is increasingly complex and interconnected, as you pointed out, Diane. And it's a world where the value increasingly comes at the intersection of different disciplines, different scientific disciplines, different ways of thinking. So the ecosystemic approach is more and more powerful, especially because all the different sciences are more complex. So this is no longer the world of Leonardo da Vinci, who could master all the different scientific disciplines and bring them together in his own mind. It's a complicated time because I think complexity and interdependence also brings greater risks and greater conflict. And in the economic sphere, you can see it very clearly now, where at the global level, there is a push towards more fragmentation, more trade wars. And the trade wars are, to some extent, the consequence of two things. One is over the past 20 years, we've paid the price of the risks that come from a very interdependent, interconnected system. All it takes is a shock somewhere, an earthquake somewhere, and supply chains break down. The second part is that in many cases, there are winners and losers. And naturally, it tends to create more of a fixed approach where people tend to think that this is a zero-sum game and people lose sight of the advantages of this approach. So this actually, to me, brings to mind the importance of connections and systems of connections theory. And the question of how do you see the evolution? I know you've made the point in the past that current systems of connection appear to be collapsing, even though we're in a world that is more interconnected and more people can make themselves heard and reach audiences. But I think this observation that the current systems are collapsing is very interesting. So I'd love you to tell more and also to get your view on what comes next. How do we replace them? What do we replace them with? And can it help us square the circle between actually maintaining the ecosystemic approach in this complex world while managing the risks and downsides?
That's a question.
That's a lot.
I read something recently that just said, bless this mess, which is our systems of connections right now. I mean, obviously, X is the big example, right? Where people would say, hey, this has become not particularly healthy. And in that, so that's sort of the dumpster fire example. But then you have on the other side, even something like LinkedIn that is a little bit more benign, it should be better. Right? Like what are we doing? Why can't we evaluate talent more? They've developed an incredible database. They have a great business model, but in terms of serving the community, and that's why when we talk about two-sided marketplaces, like serving the community, not just serving the back end, right, is a really important thing. So, and I think actually there's an inherent tension between broadcasting and dialogue where we tend towards broadcast models. And that's part of why my background keeps coming back, because people want a bullhorn, right? They want to tell you how it is, as opposed to setting up systems with structures that increase dialogue. And so I've been hearing a lot recently of people who are super frustrated with LinkedIn because they would like better talent search, better ways to evaluate how someone thinks, as opposed to just a personalized broadcast platform, which is where it gets with influencers and content creators, right? They all have these channels. And that's different than actually fostering something. So I think what we're trying to do, if you start to think about community and connections, can you create something where there is content? Because content is definitely part of all this. But then also, when you structure a custom community with an area, a focused area of inquiry, does that help change the dynamics here. We know that DARPA hired people based on their contributions on polyplexus. We know that ARPA-H looked at talent based on that, not just the ideas, but the talent. But as people look at the larger sort of connection landscape, I think there was some interesting research that came out just recently that the big platforms are losing trust. Digital spaces are definitely coming up short compared to real relationships. Even while they connect and reconnect people, they fall short at some point. AI is powerful, but not always welcome in these spaces. And that probably there's some sense that smaller, purpose-driven communities are the future. And so those can be based on a common goal. They can be based on a common area of inquiry. Right. But how are we structuring this conversation? Think about going to just a party where anyone can say anything and someone's more interesting than someone else. And you try to get out of the conversation you're in with the person who's less interesting and get over here to the person that's more interesting versus a conversation where, hey, we're going to talk about this, a more of a salon structure. We're going to talk about this and bring your experience to bear on this to enlighten everybody. So it's really looking at those kind of drivers, I think. There's some really interesting work going on in media around this. There's a woman named Jennifer Brandel, and she had an amazing piece on New York Public Radio about the interstitium. I don't know if it was a new organ in the body, and it's a connective tissue. And we didn't see it for a really long time because when we would dissect, I hope I'm not mangling the science here, but when we would dissect bodies, it was dried out, and you really could only see it once we could actually observe the body in action while it was living. And so they're actually creating models based on the interstitium to develop press communities around news and information. And that's an area that's under so much stress right now, the press. And so they're really looking for different ways to try to organize information and try to report on information and gather resources. So I think there's so much happening in this area, but that idea of the big network that's got a billion people. Yay. That's, I think, less helpful to a lot of people. That's why Reddit is where, so these ideas where you have a big community, but it's organized into separate channels and it's organized into separate spaces. Substack is trying to do some things that are similar, but all these things are ways of sharing information. And I think you can take a lot from all of them. And the sciences in particular haven't been great at that sharing of information. They've had sort of very specific ways you do this. And a lot of it is for real reasons like peer review and important things. But the connection and then the connection between disciplines and the translation that has to happen could take some pages from some of these emerging structures.
So the days of the super app are numbered at this point, I'm hearing. All right.
It's probably going to be really big and really smaller. And then the in-between is not, it's going to be right. Less middle, maybe.
Yes, so right.
So I'm wondering, I'll make just one quick cynical comment, Diane. Maybe not cynical, but my concern is whether the problem is 80% us and only 20% the technology and the platforms, right? And because it's like we do have very healthy and nutritious food out there. We choose not to eat it, but it's not that it's out there. And we're just not being educated to search what is good for us and to do the hard work. And I'm wondering if part of the problem is through the education system, we're not being taught and incentivized to do the hard work that is needed to get value out of the different digital channels and platforms. Probably need action on both sides.
That's 100% fair. I think they're sort of showing that critical thinking is on the wane. But I do think if you come out of media ecosystems, there is always a dance between broadcasting and narrowcasting. The broadcasting serves to bring the community together and to drive consensus and to get people on the same page to some extent. And the narrowcasting is really sort of much more about exploring a specific subject matter or maybe something a little bit more rigorous. You can still do this on X. You can just make sure that your curated list of people that you follow are people that you expect. But the problem is it starts to take out serendipity. I don't get introduced to something I didn't know. I don't know what I don't know. So that becomes the echo chambers. So then you need to go back to the broader pool. And so I think it's that dance between the broadcasting and the narrowcasting, but that doesn't mean I don't think that we love a junk food diet, and clickbait is a junk food diet. There's no question.
No doubt. No doubt. And it really does come back to systems of information and incentive, right? Ultimately, the systems of information and incentive need to be carefully kind of architected and maintained so that systems of information don't become victim of the systems of incentive, right? Because honestly, the truth and trust are currencies in this ecosystemic world, right? If a system loses trust, then basically it will collapse upon itself.
Which is really important. This is not about mining. To that idea, you discover the ideas, but you want the community to discover the ideas. You don't want someone to come in and just say, I'm mining this for ideas that I can take and make good. So when we talk about the two-sided, it's really important that there be benefits on both sides, right? That's the incentive to continue to contribute.
We've talked about the interplay between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, and that too is a dance these days. We're seeing human agents and digital agents trade roles, and as one begins to evolve its role, then the other will adjust or adapt its role. So it's a really interesting dance, and it affects the way we conduct commerce. It will affect the way we educate tomorrow's leaders and tomorrow's workforce. So how do we need to be thinking about vertical expert networks? And how does that change the way we can deploy AI or should be deploying AI in basically into our lives and general platforms of society, industry, and policy?
That's such a big question. And it's changing. I think I just saw something this morning, maybe it was Nature, about emergent strategies for AI negotiation. And there were some takeaways from this research that said, look, AI for deep prep, humans for real-time adaptation. Humans can interpret cues and adjust strategies dynamically, but the setup would be by AI. Then there's this idea of blending AI precision with human warmth for exactly what you're talking about, trust building and relationship building, because we know that there's buy-in. You have to buy in. Everything isn't just so, you know, this is empirically proven to be true, so you should just buy in. People don't do that. And so I think this field is really evolving and trying to understand how to do that. So I was lucky enough to get invited to a retreat that was sponsored by some folks at MIT, where we really talked about the state of AI this fall and where it was going and where it could go. And I wanted to float an idea. I am by no means an AI expert. But in my space, what I was thinking is, look, if the human in the loop is always behind because you have a network as big as Facebook, and so you're sitting there and you're trying to suss out whether or not results are correct, why couldn't in a vertical social network where people are experts, why couldn't you put that right up front? Could I, in fact, create a profile for an AI agent to participate in a Polyplex's discussion? And the community, by virtue of the social networking things that are built into the platform, could let us know whether or not the additions to the discussion were helpful or not. And so could we figure out ways to just put this right out front? So I didn't know. And so I asked some of the very, very smart people that were there, and they said, yeah, it's just not something that has been done a lot. But I think that it's conceivably possible. It's something that we really want to explore, to sort of put it out there in front and say, hey, how does it work in an expert environment? As opposed to how does it work in that broadcast environment where you're trying to... So I don't know. And that's sort of a question to be determined. But that is one area that I'm extremely interested in trying to drive this. And on Polyplexus.
Yeah, I think you're doing a great job of getting after that with Polyplexus. And I love the experimentation kind of culture that you have in what you're building with Polyplexus. I believe, and I'm still kind of working through this in our work as well, but I really believe that the combination of AI and HI, human intelligence, really informs the ecosystemic intelligence, right? The competencies, the capabilities, and the potential of innovation and economic resilience within any given network and set of sub-networks, right? So it's curating.
100%. Let's add a facet, though. This just came out, Flagship Pioneering annual letter for 2025, focused on what they call polyintelligence. And this is how they describe it. They say, with the rise of artificial machine intelligence, we're entering a new chapter, a synthesis of human, machine, and nature's intelligence. This synthesis, which I term polyintelligence, represents the emergence of a modern day renaissance where it combines human creativity and imagination, nature's adaptive genius, and the reach, scale, and speed of machine intelligence.
We do a lot of work comparing human ecosystems to natural ecosystems. And there are so many lessons that we could be learning and applying in those natural ecosystems history, right? That really represents a tremendous potential unlock for us if we take the time to map those corollaries.
So. Yeah. And what I really like about that too, is it takes us out of this binary human and machine.
Right.
And it starts to say, wait, it is actually more about collective intelligence. Brookings has a great piece on collective intelligence that's just out, and the science of collective intelligence and this idea of acting, bonding, and ritual, the way they sort of think about it, not just for people across disciplines, but also natural systems.
Yes.
And then how do we introduce machine learning into that? I think all of this is so fascinating how it's developing, and there's so much potential. But I think, Margot, go back to what you're saying, if we can get out of our own way.
Exactly. And on this study, we're opening really new perspectives for what the future might look like. We've had a very fascinating discussion on the progress already made, especially with new technologies and platforms like Polyplexus. We talked about the intersection and interaction of human intelligence and artificial intelligence. Now you're bringing in the natural intelligence element as well. Let's imagine the future. Let's look at the next 5, 10, 20 years. How do you see this evolving? So what kind of new platforms will emerge? What kind of new ecosystemic collaborations can emerge from this interaction of human, machine, nature? How do they actually work? How are they different from what we've seen so far? And what do you think opens up in terms of potential impact?
What's the future?
Yep.
I ask the simple questions here, Terry.
That's all. Just tell us what the future is. So let's talk about sports for a second. You go every night to a different place. You plug in. You assemble a group of experts who are experts in video and experts in audio and experts in commentating, and you produce a live event where you do not know what the result will be, but you actually have a structure by which you do it because you know what the playing field is, you know what the rules are. And so these are fluid systems, right? You add that to the mix. The vision that we have is that you, and I can't tell you what the future is, but the vision that we have is in our space is, can we recreate a series of conversations on a platform with experts who can wander in and out of these conversations, but they are structured such that there are outputs from each of these things. And then you can follow both people and ideas, and you can see which ideas are getting connected most frequently. And you can sort of trace this. And there's a longitudinal value to this, but it doesn't have to have happened in the last 5 minutes. It could be an older concept that we just didn't know what to do with. So these fluid systems of connections, something about this is it's about fluidity. It's not about locking in. So it's structure that doesn't impede the fluidity of the thought or the access to the information. And I think that's maybe the holy grail of how this works, whether or not human behavior becomes a constraining factor in that is hard to say. But I think with the proper incentives and just enough friction, just enough structure to sort of steer us towards a north, but enough flexibility within that to accommodate this divergent thinking, orthogonal thinking, that's the goal, right? That's where you want to try to get to. And then using machine learning natural learnings to inform some of that. But I do think if you are going to talk about natural learnings, the science of CI does integrate that molecular level biological systems thinking in that. And I think if you just, I really like that frame of acting, bonding, and ritual. So we have, there's a bias for action. There's a bonding that happens. That's the relational. And then there's a ritual and a way that people expect it to move forward to some extent. I'm not sure there's going to be one answer, but I think we could create some systems that are good at different points in the system, right? So like right now, we're looking to inform with the latest information, how we're going to write this proposal, or how we're going to think about this problem, or how we're going to develop this question. Right now, we're going to look backwards to what we learned and move it forwards. So it's a series of moments, I think, in this discussion that, and there's probably also a group of tools that are important in that. But you guys are the systemic experts. So I throw that back at you, Marco. What's the future?
I'll say, never ask an economist what the future is. It's a very, very bad idea. But I'll say the following. You mentioned incentives, and I think that is crucial because I do think humans will get in the way. Unfortunately, it is our nature, but we need all the help we can get. So the right frameworks. And I think we're in this almost uncanny valley where we've gotten drunk on our ability to produce large platforms and millions of connections. And now we are realizing how destructive that is. And we're slowly starting the process of putting, as you said, more structure on it to make it more useful, more efficient. With more structure and with the right incentives in, I think we are going to be able to create the right set of ecosystems because the value is there. As we said before, there is zero doubt that these ecosystemic approaches, especially as you manage to combine serendipity and structure and focus, are tremendously powerful. To me as an economist, means they create economic value, and therefore there is a very powerful incentive once you realize what they can do to pursue them and leverage them. So I'm actually quite optimistic on this front. I think we do need to fix the basics, which I think is more attention to human capital and human cognition. But with that, I think these ecosystemic models are going to be tremendously powerful. But again, I'm an economist. What do I know?
You're right. You'd be surprised how many conversations we have when we talk to someone about doing something like this. And you say, what is the incentive for the community to participate? And they can't answer the question. Right. And the incentives don't have to be extreme. There are intrinsic and extrinsic incentives, and they don't have to be large. Sure, $25 million is a great incentive. But we've run programs where it was $2,000 and $2,040 because it was about a result for 2040. So what evidence have you seen that you think would become a full-scale industry by 2040? And by the way, if you win, you get $2,040. And you still get that same participation, but it is really about aligning an incentive and a reason why, a meaning. Why am I doing this? Part of what's the problem, I think, with X and some of these larger platforms is, why are we doing this?
Yes.
Why should I put this out there? What is the point? Now, if I'm an influencer, I get what the point is. I'm making money if I'm a content creator. But generally speaking, that misalignment of incentives is the biggest problem right now in that world, right? What are we trying to do? And so these custom communities where you're actually exploring a common problem with some aligned incentive is directional, right? Okay, we're looking at it from this perspective. Here's what we're trying to identify. Here's how we're trying to collaborate to see if we could come up with a solution. And my incentive is I could get this idea out there. I could potentially get funding, whatever that is. So these are basic things. We've just forgotten them.
I think to your point, Terry, if we think about the future, right, as maybe systems of systems and not necessarily technological systems, but ecosystems of ecosystem, we as humans have many facets to us, and those facets evolve as we age, right? And so incentive that motivates us when we're 24 may be very different from incentive that motivates us when we're 54. Generally speaking, and oversimplifying, incentives generally boil down to money, love, and glory. And it's not always monetary incentive that will compel action. But if we think about that and recognize that these ecosystemic models are models of abundance, not zero-sum models, then that gives us greater design freedom, right? And ecosystems can have clusters of alignment around different missions and problems. And if we recognize that as the infrastructure of the future, the economic model of the future, right, in my ideal world, that allows us to, as human agents in these systems, compartmentalize what motivates us from a personal interest perspective, a professional interest perspective at any point in our evolution, right? We can engage with this ecosystem solving this problem at this point using this fraction of our capacity and capability while engaging with this other ecosystem solving this problem. And I can bring this area of interest and expertise to that problem set, right? If we give ourselves the freedom to engage in a more dynamic and elastic way, then I think we can start to unlock more of the creative capacity and the kind of execution capacity that we can bring to the table as human agents. But that requires a very thoughtful architecture of ecosystemic framework, systems of incentive, information, basically a currency of trust and truth, right? But it's a bit of a departure from the way we've been operating over the past century.
Or the way we've been thinking about architecture, right? Yes. It's funny, this is my favorite comment that we got back after we did the ARPA-H program. And this is from a PhD. The content was fantastic fun, and my company is in negotiations with the winners to help them create a different drug candidate for inhalational use. It's a great opportunity for both of us and for the ultimate recipients of the drug if we're so fortunate to prove its effectiveness. And it never would have occurred if it weren't for this particular contest or for Polyplexus in general. And so it starts to talk about that idea of how do you take a digital community and move it to real life? And community in real life is real work. There's a workload there. It's great to put these people up there and say, hey, everyone's talking and it's frictionless and we're in digital world and everybody's an expert. But then how do you do the hard work of creating the community outside of that interface? We're not going to live every moment in our interfaces. We are more than our interfaces. So I think that speaks to what you're talking about as well. The architecture of what happens and when it happens and the architecture of it in real life, not just online. So there's a continuum that we're moving back and forth on.
Yeah. And I think the inverse of that too, right? For those legacy operations and communities that have operated in the analog world, the physical world, lifting some of those kind of missions into the digital world can be a very kind of foreign exercise, right? Getting them to bridge the trust and the relationships and the operations into digital arenas with working with folks and agents with whom they might not be familiar and may never meet. So I think there's just such a tremendous opportunity in front of us. And I am sure that we could continue talking about this for hours, but we are coming up to the top of our hour here.
And we talked about natural intelligence, and I see a wagging tail next to you, Diane. This is nature's intelligence coming to keep us on track.
Yes, and you heard her chime in. She had something to say about that. But no, she's my co-conspirator here. But as we reflect on some of the heavy topics that we covered here today, I think we've solved world hunger and world peace in the margins of this conversation, I'm quite sure. But Jerry, as we think about some of the key themes we want to make sure our listeners, our community, walk away with today, what are some of the top of mind for you? What are some of the really critical recommendations or suggestions that you would have for our listeners here today?
I think it's helpful to think about this as things change. How are we going to architect the systems of polyintelligence for the future that reflect all the facets of that polyintelligence, right? The machine learning, the AI, the human creativity and imagination, the adaptability, the relational situation, as well as the natural system. What is the architecture of the new systems? I think that's the question before us. in whether or not it's systems of systems. I don't think it's the Uber system, but I think that idea of really thoughtfully exploring the architecture and the incentives of these communication mechanisms and the communities that we're going to need collectively to solve these problems, that's a worthy challenge.
It is a critical challenge, and it's one that we're grateful that you're leading the cause. We're grateful for the work that you're doing. It's a really exciting time. It truly is a renaissance moment. So we have Leonardo da Vinci's example to follow, to live up to, Marco, to your earlier point, but this is a renaissance moment for humanity, and it's a really exciting time to be thinking about these challenges ahead. Marco, any final thoughts from you?
No, just that I'm more optimistic now because I think we are at a fork in the road where either something like these new platforms and new systems we've talked about brings us back into a new renaissance, or we're going to slide back into the Middle Ages. Well, before our conversation, I would have given you a 60-40 chance that we're back to the Middle Ages in a few years. Now I'm 70-30 for the new renaissance.
Moving in the right direction. All right. We're wearing them down, Terry. This is a good thing. All right. With that, I'm 95.5. So I'm the optimist in the group here. But with that, I think we're going to wrap it up for the day. And Terry, you've been amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you for the work that you're leading. It's brilliant. We will continue to follow in your digital wake. And I'm sure that our listeners will as well. To our listeners, thank you again. You've been listening to Ecosystemic Futures with our guest, Terry Schindler. If you'd like to explore the concepts that we've discussed further, check out our show notes for links to polyplexus.com, the ARPA-H platform, and the articles regarding the original DARPA research that Terry mentioned. We'll put as much of that in the show notes as we can for you. And for those that are interested in learning more about Terry's work, of course, you can find her at HerzogSchindler.com or connect with her on LinkedIn. As always, we invite you to continue the conversation online and share your thoughts about today's conversation. And thank you again, as always, as we explore the interconnected networks shaping our future. Until next time, I'm Diane Finkhausen for Ecosystemic Futures. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.